Excellent, thank you. Okay. All right. So, you had a good lunch, everyone? Yeah, good lunch? Okay, good. That's excellent. So now we can come back to the suttas again. We're going to carry on with the Potalia Sutta on all the similes on the kind of downside of the sensory world. And we have looked, maybe the two first similes are maybe are very powerful. There's more powerful similes coming up, and some of them are quite strong. I just have to warn you. So, but they are, nevertheless, I would say they're interesting here, even though they're strong. And sometimes, if you feel that they are too strong and hard to relate to, then just remember that they are there for your contemplation, not for your kind of a complete acceptance or just, yes, sir, this is the way it is. But, you know, think about them, reflect on them, and see if they make sense to you. So the next simile here is as follows. Now, where is it? Suppose a person carrying a blazing grass torch was to walk against the wind. What do you think, householder? If that person doesn't quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't they burn their hands or arm or other limb, resulting in death or death-like suffering for them? Yes, sir. And then I have elided a lot of what is there, but then, of course, it carries on with, you know, this is similar to sensual pleasures or similar to the five senses, etc. So what does this mean? And the thing about this similes, and this is kind of some of the most evocative thing in the suttas, are the similes that the Buddha uses, the metaphors that he uses, often very powerful and interesting. And what I would recommend you to do is to reflect on these similes for yourself and see what they mean to you. Because basically they mean a little bit different for each one of us. Yeah, they are, they have, you know, they have different angles, they have different degrees of, or different different kind of angles you can look at them from, and so they actually mean often different things to different people, and all of those different meanings may in fact turn out to be true. Of course, there are wrong interpretations, but there may be many good ones. And it reminds me of one of the suttas. I think it's in the somewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Numerical Discourses, where there is a verse that has been spoken by the Buddha at some point, and then there's all these monks coming together. And then they ask each other, well, what is your interpretation of this verse? And each of these six monks, seven monks, they give a different interpretation of the verse. So what does that mean? Does that mean that they're all wrong, or does it mean they're all right? And very interesting, then they go to the Buddha, and they say to the Buddha, well, this is the verse, this is what I say it means, this is what he says it means, which one of us, who is right? And the Buddha says, you're all right. That's kind of fascinating, right? So often there isn't necessarily one right interpretation. And then the Buddha goes on to give another alternative interpretation, yeah, the seventh one or whatever it is. So, and same thing with these similes and the metaphors and the suttas. Often they have kind of many layers of meanings. And so see how it makes sense to you. What I'm going to tell you is kind of how I regard these things, but there may be more to it. Guaranteed there's more to it, I should say. So the idea of the grass torch, right? So you carrying a grass torch, or taking it up or carrying it, and this would be, to my mind, similar to carrying the sensual objects of the world, right? Carrying them means attaching to them. It doesn't mean you kind of literally carry them, you attach to them. So you carry them in a mental sense as a kind of burden. And then you carry that torch against the wind. And of course, grass torch against the wind, it's going to be all the kind of the blowback from all the embers, that kind of thing. And before you know it, your robe is going to be ablaze, or your clothes are going to be ablaze. So what does it mean to carry things against the wind? And I think what it means is that you attach to things in the wrong way, not clear about the danger of attachment, not knowing that if you hold on to things in the world too strongly, everything in the world is impermanent. You grasp onto impermanent things, you're going to suffer. It's kind of obvious. Yeah, so much of the Dhamma is about impermanence, and I think this is just another example of that. So we learn instead to grasp things that we need to live. So we need to kind of hold things in the right way. Don't attach wrongly. Don't hold the grass torch against the wind, maybe with the wind. And what that means is that, yes, we use the things in the world, but we realize that there is a higher purpose. There's something more that we are striving for, something higher that we want to attain. And in that sense, we don't grasp so firmly onto the things of the world. Now, one of the important things to realize in the Dhamma is that you hear Buddhist people say, yeah, I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't grasp anything. But actually, that doesn't work like that. I shouldn't grasp anything. You're going to grasp, whether you want to or not, you're going to grasp things, because that's just the nature of the mind. The mind, which, where there's a sense of self, grasping must happen as a consequence. Why is that? Well, because the sense of self, that very idea of a sense of self must have a certain content. And because that sense of self has a content, maybe the will, maybe certain perceptions that you have, maybe the act of knowing, whatever it is that you, whatever qualities you give that sense of self, that you will grasp, because that you take as you. You cannot not grasp it if you take it to be you. That's part of the definition of having a sense of self, is that you grasp onto that. And because you grasp onto things in the world, and even these things like the will, the perceptions that we have, knowing even those things are impermanent, it's going to be problematic. And of course, that idea of the self then doesn't stop with the five khandhas, doesn't stop with what is internal to you. It also goes into the world, because then we want to satisfy that self in various ways. We want to use that will in the world to gather things, etc., etc. And so for this reason, attachment is part and parcel of having a sense of self. The two things go together. And so what we need to do then is not to just say, I'm not going to have any attachments, because you can't just wave the magic wand and bing, now no more attachments. You have to practice gradually this path. And as you let go of some more basic base attachments, you grasp onto a higher rung on that ladder of attachments, hold on to something else, and then you can gradually let go of the lower ones, going up to higher things later on. So it's like a gradual process of moving out of attachment. And so this is what I think maybe is what is meant here by the idea of holding the grass torch. You have to hold the grass torch. You have to have some kind of attachment, but you hold it in such a way that it leads you out of that dependence, out of the problem, rather than just kind of leading to more issues, more things down the track. Something like that. Okay, so that's the simile of the grass torch for you. And now comes one of the most challenging of all the similes in this particular sutta. And it goes as follows. Suppose there was a pit of glowing coals, deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals that neither flamed nor smoked. Then a person would come along who wants to live and doesn't want to die, who wants to be happy and recoils from pain. Then two strong men would grab them by the arms and drag them towards that pit of glowing coals. What do you think, householder? Wouldn't that person writhe and struggle to and fro? Yes, sir. Why is that? For that person knows if I fall into that pit of glowing coals, that would result in my death or death-like pain. So, that's pretty challenging, right? So the glowing coals, the pit, that's the sensual world for you, huh? A pit of glowing coals. And if you knew how bad those sensual world was, you would writhe to and fro, trying to get out of the grip of Mara, right? And run away from that delicious lunch you just had a few hours ago. So how do we even begin to understand this? It's hard to understand. Well, first of all, please have your lunch. Don't take this too seriously. It's important that you enjoy your lunch. One of the things I love about my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, is that he says, enjoy your food, right? And I'm very good at enjoying my food, so I really appreciate that. Because the idea is that, if you live a monastic life, in daily life, you have to enjoy the things that you do. If you don't even enjoy eating, And first of all, probably your digestion is not great if you don't enjoy the kind of the food. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying it. The problem really is if you crave too much. So if you come back to your cute in the evening and you kind of think about food all evening, well, then there's a problem, because then there's too much attachment and craving here. But just enjoying the meal, that's just actually, it's not a big problem. So understanding these things in the right way. So what does this mean? How can we kind of get our heads around this? And one of the ways that I like to think about this is that it's a bit like smoking cigarettes. Yeah, I don't know if any of you have ever smoked cigarettes or been addicted to that. I did smoke occasional cigarettes when I was young and trying to be cool. But I never actually had an addiction to it, so I was very happy to get to avoid that. You know what it's like when you smoke a cigarette, even though the first time you have it is terrible. I mean, it's absolutely, you're kind of coughing and kind of, on the one hand you're trying to be cool, on the other hand you're kind of coughing kind of behind everyone's back and pretending you're all right or whatever. But it actually is terrible. But then once you get addicted to it, you can't stop. You have to have it, even though the taste is exactly the same, even though it doesn't, you know, there's nothing there. You have to have that cigarette, and it's as if it is the most pleasant thing in the world. Why is it pleasant? Well, it's pleasant, not because it actually tastes good, because we know it doesn't taste good. It's pleasant because the craving is so strong. It's the ending of the craving that is pleasant. And so it's kind of madness, right? You build up a habit that leads to craving, and then that craving is just the pleasure of getting rid of the craving. That is what it is about. Isn't that kind of crazy? You can see how nuts that whole idea is. And that is exactly what a large part of sensual pleasures are like. And of course, among the sensual pleasures, the kind of pleasure that has the highest kind of craving and desire is obviously sexuality. And sexuality, a large part of sexuality, maybe not all of it, but a large part of it, is just the overcoming of the craving, getting rid of that restlessness, the agitation, which is part of it. And once you see that, the whole thing kind of starts to collapse a little bit. It is no longer so important. It's hard to see, because it is a place where so many people find their meaning and purpose. But it is so involved with craving and desire, you cannot really take it out from that. And that is what they say. If you are fully enlightened, you cannot actually have any kind of sexuality. Why? Because it is so involved with craving, and craving has come to an end when you get to that particular point. So, to me, this is kind of a way of understanding this. But to give another point of view, this particular simile is also expanded on in one of the other suttas in the Pali Canon, the Magandhya Sutta, which is found in the Middle Length Sayings, number 76. And in that sutta, the Buddha explains this particular simile to a wanderer. And this is a strange kind of wanderer, Magandhya. He is a wanderer who indulges in sensual pleasure. That's kind of his spiritual practice. Okay, well, kind of strange. And he goes around saying, this is Nibbana, this is the highest, indulging in all kinds of sensual pleasures. This is the Nirvana, this was Nirvana in his kind of teaching. And anyway, so the Buddha comes, or they meets with the Buddha, one way or another, and then the Buddha says to him, well, I'll give you a simile to kind of show it to you why this doesn't really work. And the simile of the Buddha is the simile of the leper. You know the illness leprosy? Leprosy is kind of this, you get all these blisters and sores on your hand, and sometimes you lose even joints or your fingers. It's kind of a really terrible thing. And it's almost eradicated now worldwide, but there's still a few places in the world where leprosy exists apparently. So he said, well, imagine a leper. A leper has the wounds that they have, often get infected with the maggots and things, so they're incredibly itchy, really, really super duper itchy. And so the leper, they would go to a fire, and they would burn themselves on the fire, because it's the only way to get kind of a measure of relief from that itchiness, which is so terrible. They would literally put their hands or feet over a burning fire and burn it so as to get away from that itchiness. It's kind of terrible, right? But actually, they get a measure of satisfaction from that. And so, you know, so then the Buddha says to him, well, you know, this is what happens with the leper, but then the leper finds a doctor. And the doctor, the physician, is able to cure them. And then the Buddha says to Magandhya, well, would that leper, after being cured, would they still go back to that fire and burn their limbs in that fire? And of course not, says Magandhya, right? Well, why not, says the Buddha? Well, because beforehand, their faculties were distorted. So what they perceived as pleasant actually was painful. Yeah, the thing was painful even though they perceived it as pleasant. And then the Buddha says, well, that is exactly the problem with sensual pleasures. You perceive all of this craving, all of these things, you perceive it as pleasurable when actually it is painful. So we need to make a distinction here between the craving aspect of sensual pleasures and the actual pleasure itself, because these are different things. I think I mentioned before that even an arahant, even someone who comes out of a jhana state, is actually able to enjoy the sensual pleasure, but without craving. Yeah. It is the craving that is painful, because the craving is an agitated thing inside. And if you're able to see just the craving, the agitation, the restlessness, that driving force in the mind, if you're able to isolate that and see just that, it is not very difficult to see that actually it is painful. Yeah, it stops you from being calm. It stops you from being peaceful. It stops you from being at ease and relaxed. Yeah, but because we conflate the craving and the actual pleasure that is there. And with some sensual pleasure, there's almost just craving. With other sensual pleasure, there's also more of a real pleasure aspect, because we conflate the two. That is why we have this kind of problem. So, charcoal pit, this is the sensual world for you, especially those very powerful cravings in that world. So please don't believe me, or please don't even believe the Buddha. Buddha is saying this. Just think about it and see if maybe, even though it's challenging, maybe there might be some truth to this. Okay, so let's have a look at the next simile here. Suppose a person was to see delightful parks, woods, meadows, and lotus ponds in a dream, but when they woke up, they couldn't see them at all. They couldn't see any of it. This is another simile for sensual pleasures. It's like a dream. Yeah? It's almost the thing that never arrives, the thing that is always in the future, always to come, the result, the contentment and satisfaction that is promised by the voice of craving whispering in your ear is always lying to you. The truth is that contentment and fulfillment never actually arrives. And there is a nice sutta, a sutta called the Samiddhi Sutta. It's about this young monk called Samiddhi. And this young monk, Samiddhi, he was kind of bathing. Yeah, in India, they had hot springs, so he was kind of bathing in these hot springs. And he had come out from his bath, and he was kind of drying himself and standing in his kind of robe. And then as he was standing there drying himself, this devata, this god, probably a goddess, right? It kind of creates a bit more tension if it's a female god and then a young monk, right? It kind of makes it interesting. Yeah. So it's always like that in the world, that this is the kind of setup that makes things interesting. Yeah. And so this goddess comes, and she comes to this monk Samiddhi, and she says, "You're a young man. You're in the kind of early prime of life. There's all these pleasures in the world, yeah? Why are you wasting away in these robes? Why are you torturing yourself, shaving your head and wearing these funny clothes? It doesn't say exactly that, but, you know, roughly something like that. Why don't you just go into the world and enjoy sensual pleasures? Yeah, you're in the prime of life. Everything, you got everything. You can have everything you want. What are you doing?" And she says, "What you are looking for, this Nibbana business, is way off in the future. Sensual pleasures, they are available right here and now." And then the Samiddhi replies to her. He replies, and he's obviously getting a bit of wisdom. He says, "No, it's the other way around. It is the Dhamma that is available right here and now. Sensual pleasures are always in the future." And then, I mentioned this many years ago, because I do travel quite a bit, and I was in Indonesia, and I was on the kind of the famous island of Borneo. I was in a small town called Balikpapan, And they had this kind of large event there, all the Buddhists in the area coming together, and there, you know, hundreds of people at that talk, and there was a young man sitting just in front of me. And so I turned to this young man, and I said, well, what do you think? Who is right, the Devata or the monk Samidhi? And he said, the Devata is right, the Devata is right. I think he was mostly joking, right, because they're having a good time together. But the interesting thing, of course, is that it's Samidhi. It is the monk who is right. And it's one of these almost koan-like statements in the Pali Suttas. And there are sometimes these statements that seem very contradictory and very counter to our normal experience of the world, but which, when you reflect on it carefully, you realize it is right. And this is a kind of slightly koan-like, slightly paradoxical statement about the world. So I think we probably all get it that the monk is probably right, yeah? But why is it that the monk is right? It sounds reasonable, okay, the sensual pleasures are right here, for goodness sake. Actually, really right here, yeah? Extremely close. It's not super-duper pleasurable, but it's good for the throat. It's kind of a sensual pleasure. It's kind of exactly the right kind of sensual pleasure for a monk, so thank you, Zakir. So what is the issue at stake here? And what is at stake is that sensual pleasures, are precisely because they are so involved with craving, they are always about the future. They're always about this dream of something coming true, a dream of a reality that never actually arrives. So because of that, they are never actually present. They're always about moving on, always about the future. But as I said before, the Dhamma has the opposite quality. Yeah, when you do something that is just, even just an ordinary Dhamma thing, like doing an act of generosity or kindness or whatever, there is an immediate happiness that actually is now in the present moment, that is not about the future. And the deeper you go on the Dhamma path, the deeper your meditation is, the deeper your wisdom is, the more that is true. The Dhamma is here and now. And then eventually, when you attain Nibbana, of course, that is fully present moment, 100%. So this is kind of the paradox behind this. Yeah. So the sensory world is always like this dream. It's something that never comes true. And I remember when I was young, you know, I had dreams of what my future was going to be like. I was not dreaming about being a monk, I can assure you of that. I was dreaming about maybe this kind of girlfriend, maybe that kind of job. And when you're young, you're really conceited about your abilities. I had this kind of fantastic ideas about what I was going to do with my life. Of course, completely, utterly wrong, absolute waste of time. And you end up as a Buddhist monk instead. It's kind of fascinating. So our dreams are so incredibly unreliable. And these things never actually turn out the way we think they're going to be. When we're young, got completely the wrong ideas about what romance really is about. Actually, it's not about what you think it's about at all. It's about, I'm not going to say what it's about, but anyway, it's just very different. No, I don't, sometimes you just have to know your limits about what you should talk about. So the idea is that the world is very different from what we think it is like. What we see in our mind, what craving tells us, what a wonderful it is to get this house. And what we very often see, we see the point of getting the house, but we don't see after that. If you want to get into a relationship with somebody, you see up to the point of getting into the relationship, and oh, it's so exciting and interesting, and then you forget what happens after that relationship has begun. Because it is the after. It's like the movies. The movies always end up, not always, but sometimes they end up with kind of the hero riding off into the sunset, right? But what happens after he goes into the sunset? Right? After the sunset, there is the dishwashing that has to be done, right? And this is why they never show you this in the movies, because that is not interesting at all. The reality of life is often very mundane. It's very ordinary. It's the ordinary things that we have to do. And this is one of those beautiful little mantras that Ajahn Brahm taught me fairly early on when I was a monk. And he said, the question you should always ask yourself, especially if you have some kind of idea of sensual pleasures or whatever it is, always ask yourself the question, and then what? And then what breaks the illusion? It breaks the illusion because the illusion ends at that point where you're having some kind of success, and you forget to ask what happens after that. And then what breaks that spell? And when you break the spell, you start to see the larger reality, and that's when you can make good decisions. So the spell of the dream is broken. And that's kind of very powerful. So ask yourself that sometimes when you make a decision. And then what? Is this a good decision? Is it really going to bring me happiness? What's going on there? Simple little things that can be very profound. Yeah. Let's do some meditation together. Okay. Okay, anyone have any comments or questions or anything they want to bring up at this point? Yes, please.
So I can think of a lot of activities that are like, they're not based on craving necessarily, but that I do because like research shows it's good for your mental health, like playing music or like going for a walk or exercising. So I wonder how do those fall within like, Buddhism and it's not craving, but it's not spiritual either. So
I think the, this is all about kind of taking this as a gradual kind of path, you know, gradual training and knowing where to start. And the starting point is always just with your precepts. Yeah, you keep the five precepts and then you kind of keep your kind of whatever, you keep your sensory realm within those five precepts. And then you add things like just kindness and generosity. Yeah, and so you keep again, so you are kind of circumscribing your world with the kind of spiritual ideas that kind of hold it within a certain realm. And so when it comes to things like exercise, I think it's important. Yeah, everyone should exercise. Even monks need some exercise at some point. So it is important to do that. But you keep it within limits, right? You don't kind of try to create the most perfect body in the world, that kind of stuff, you know? Some people are extremely obsessed with their bodies. And that is not a good idea when you know it's going to end up in a little pile of ash down the track, yeah? And then it's going to be burnt up and nothing incinerated. Yeah? So you keep yourself in reasonable shape because then that tends to clear the mind and the kind of mind and body often kind of go together to some extent. And if you want to play a bit of music, no problem. You mean like playing instruments? So what do you mean? Yeah, okay, yeah, good. I don't think it's a big issue either. And sometimes people ask, well, you know, we're Buddhists, what, you know, is it okay to even to put on some music, listen to music? And I would say, sure, it just depends on the context. Sometimes maybe you come back from work, you feel a bit stressed, and sometimes you have to kind of come down gradually from work until you feel peaceful. You're not going to feel peaceful straight away. Sometimes if you try to kind of close your eyes and meditate straight from work, you're kind of all over the place, nothing works. So you come down gradually, put on a bit of music, have a nice cup of tea, maybe even read something nice or inspiring, and then when your mind is ready, then you can do meditation or whatever. So it's all about the right thing at the right time. And it's interesting that in the in the suttas, there are sensual pleasures that are almost recommended by the Buddha. And that is kind of nature, right? Being in nature. It is a kind of sensual pleasure because it is through the senses, but it's a peaceful kind of sensual pleasures. It doesn't lead to great amount of craving or desires or whatever. It tends to incline you towards peace. So just feel what feels right. Yeah, feel how things are going. And don't be too strict on these things. I mean, living lay life means that you're part of your life is some degree of sensual pleasures, more than the monastic life is. That's just the way it is. And it has to be like that. And the reason it has to be like that, because lay life is quite busy. When you live a very busy life, it is often difficult to access the pleasures of the mind, because the mind just isn't peaceful enough. Okay, we need some kind of pleasures, so then we will have the pleasures of the senses instead, music or food or whatever it is. But as a monastic, it's the opposite the other way around. Because there is very little access to sensual pleasures, you have to have access to the pleasures of the mind. And if you haven't got that, you have nothing. So for that reason, it is very important for monastics to be able to withdraw, to go back to the monastery, to be by themselves, spend a lot of time in solitude, so they can actually access that happiness. Otherwise, there is nothing for a monastic. And so sometimes, as a monastic, you have to say no to the demands of the world, because the world always wants you to be out there and do things, right? But it's important to understand how monastic life actually is sustainable. Without that, it's not sustainable, and then it becomes really problematic. Please, yeah.
I was just wondering if there's a negative connotation to craving.
Yeah. Yes, it's craving, yeah. ideally, this is why ideally the you know, the point of the Dhamma ideally is to actually overcome all rebirth, you know. But the thing is that in Buddhism, there's kind of many levels of Buddhism, many levels, and depending on where you are at and how developed you are, all these kind of things. And, you know, at the very least, you can say that having a, at the very least, you have some kind of positive craze. Better to be reborn in heaven than to be reborn as an animal, for example, right? So you kind of have those kind of things, first of all. So you start out with the basic things, then you kind of move on later on. And those even those basic things actually make you a better human being, because how do you get reborn in the heavenly realm? Well, living with kindness. So you're kind of using that craving in a positive way to kind of start the practice of the path. Yeah. And this is again one of those things that craving, just like attachment, just like the conceit, I am, all of these things, they are inherent to us. You can't give them up like that. You have to give them up gradually. Huh? So you have to practice the path, and then stage by stage they disappear. Huh? So in a sense, you have to use craving to overcome craving. Huh? That's kind of the paradox here. Huh? There's a hierarchy of craving, exactly. So the early craving is like the craving to be kind, right? Okay, I would like to be a kind person. Huh? That is also a kind of, call it desire, maybe craving is wrong, but call it a desire at least. But it's a good desire, it leads in the right direction. And then, as you say, it's a hierarchy of desires. You get higher and higher until eventually all desires is eliminated at the very top. Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes, please.
Just regarding kindness, the desire for kindness isn't eliminated, but maybe it just happens by itself. Is that what
it is? It becomes part of your psyche.
Yeah, it's no longer a desire.
Yeah, it isn't a desire anymore. It becomes part of your psychology. You have destroyed all the motivations and things that actually make you unkind. So you are kind by default. Yeah. Okay, so let's carry on. So we had a quick look at the simile of the dream. Now comes the simile of the borrowed goods. Suppose a man had borrowed some goods, a gentleman's carriage and fine jeweled earrings, and preceded and surrounded by these, he proceeded through the middle of Apana. Apana is like a town. When people saw him, they would say, this must be a wealthy man, for that is how the wealthy enjoy their wealth. But when the owner saw him, they would take back what was theirs. What do you think? Would that be enough for that man to get upset? Yes, sir. Why is that? Because the owners took back what was theirs. So here, the sensual things of the world are called borrowed goods. Yeah, it's a very simple idea. But I think very useful, because very easy to get your mind around this particular one. I mean, all of these are, not all of them, but they are, but this one is particularly easy to get your mind around, that everything in the world is borrowed goods, especially if you have an idea of rebirth. Yeah. So, and this is the idea that some point in life, everything has to be given up. We are kind of left naked. We left where we started out. When we die, everything is gone, and you have nothing left. Everything in this world is borrowed. You have it for a while, then it's gone again. Just like this man in the simile. Yeah, and in the meantime, you kind of think you are important because you are wealthy, got this big carriage, fine jeweled earrings. It's a different era, right? It's hard to really. It doesn't really. You have to kind of get your mind into how they were thinking at that time. But and then, of course, you identify with that. Yeah, and that becomes your personality, becomes how you see yourself and all of these kind of things. Then the craving becomes even stronger. It affects your personality, how your status, how you regard yourself compared to others, all of these kind of things. It's kind of... easy. How do you, if you think about something in your life that you borrow compared to something that you own, how do you relate differently to those things? If you rent a car or if you own a car, you have a different feeling in those cases. Yeah, most people probably do, right? Or if you rent an apartment or you own an apartment, or whatever it is, there's a different feeling about it. If it's your apartment or your car, you look after it in a different way. Yeah, you get more upset if someone drives into you because it's your car. If someone drives into rent a car, okay, maybe not such a big deal, but if it's your car, it really upsets you. And in the same way, we should think about the things in our life more like rented things, like borrowed things. We have them for a while, and then sooner or later, they're gone. At the very latest, it will be gone when you die, but it is gone long before then. Yeah, someone steals it, it gets burned down. That's what happens in Australia. Things burn down all the time because so many forest fires down there. So this is kind of this idea, see everything in your life as borrowed. And it's kind of very obvious when it comes to things like our possessions. It's kind of obvious that those things are borrowed. They have to go when you die. But more difficult, it also is to do with all the people in our lives. It's like borrowed relationships, right? We have them for a while. People are there for a while. They come into our life, and then they disappear again. It's like children. People often think these are my children. But from a Buddhist point of view, children that come into your life from an unfathomable past with a pre-existing personality, and you meet together for a few years, and you depart again, and you go in different directions. That's really what children are like. That's really a more realistic view of those things. That's not what it feels like. It feels like my children, right? Don't die because I love you. But I can't help dying. This is the time to die. And so, these departures are often very painful because we forget that these things are borrowed. So everything in our life, possessions, people are borrowed. We have these relationships for a while. So much of who we take ourselves to be as people are borrowed. Our status in society, our education, our gender, our nationality, all of these kind of symbols that kind of define us in one way or another, your religion, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a monk, whatever it is, all of these things, they define us. And all of that only has meaning in this world. Once you die, it doesn't really have any meaning anymore. And then, of course, your body as well. All of these things are borrowed goods. They have to go one day. And once you start to think about the world in this way, in terms of borrowed goods, you start not to hold on quite so strongly anymore. And you start to ask yourself, well, if all of these are borrowed goods, is there anything that is not the borrowed goods? And there is one thing the Buddha says is not borrowed goods. I'm going to test your knowledge of Buddhism. What is that one thing that the Buddha says is not borrowed goods? Exactly. Yeah, well done. That's very, very, very clever. So that's good. The Buddha says you're the owner of your karma, right? Kamma-sakka. And what does that mean? Well, it means that whatever we build up of inner good qualities, they don't disappear when you die. You take those with you into the future life. Of course, it is not quite true that you're owner of your karma, because even that is impermanent eventually. But it goes much, much further than the ordinary things of the world. So the owner of the karma, if that is what you own, put your effort into the things you own, not in the things that you borrow, right? How much effort are you going to put into that rented car compared to the real car, which is actually back home? Okay, the rented car, you look after it because you're all good people. You don't not care about it. You do the right thing, but you don't over-concerned about the car that is borrowed. And then you go back home and it's your car. Okay, this is my car. You pat it on the bonnet, Okay, car. You clean it out and make it nice inside, all of these kind of things, because it's your car. So clean out those things that you own. Clean out, make beautiful, make bright those things that are really important in this world. What is that? Your mind. Make your mind bright. Make your mind light. Make it full of joy and happiness and all of these positive things, tranquility. And when you do that, that is when you're building up the one thing that you own, according to the Buddha. So this is how you change your attitude. What does it mean? Does it mean you have to become a monk or nun? No, it does not mean that. Does it mean you have to change your job? No. Does it mean you have to quit your family? No. Does it mean you have to change anything? Not on the surface of things. It's your attitude to the world that changes, not necessarily what you do. There may be some things that you don't want to do anymore because it's very hard to have the right attitude, like being a soldier in the army. It may not be the ideal way of spending your life. Or working for an arms factory may not be the best way. But As long, almost any life can be turned into a spiritual life. And it's all about how we live that life. And if you live that life in the right way, then it's going to be a common aspect of your spiritual life. And it's kind of weird, right? We can do almost exactly the same thing, but our attitude to those things is different. Instead of taking our family for granted, instead of taking our, you know, whatever it is, our husband or wife or girlfriend or boyfriend for granted, we ask ourselves, how can I be more kind? How can I look after them in a better way? Yeah, and once you do that, then it becomes spiritual. The relationship becomes spiritual. Your family life improves as a consequence. Your work life improves as a consequence. If you're kind to your colleagues go, wow, what happened? Yeah, people are often not kind to themselves in the work life, but we should be here. We should be kind to each other here. And I think, are you kind to each other here? Yeah, right, exactly, because this is a good place, right? How can you not be kind to each other when you are in a good place like this? So you practice that spiritual path throughout in everything you do. You imbue all the activities of your life with spiritual qualities, kindness, caring, compassion, generosity, all of these things. Then it becomes powerful. And of course, then it comes back to those ordinary qualities of life. The ordinary things of life improve and they become better as a consequence. So this is how small shift in perception from I own this to I, this is only borrowed, changes your entire attitude to what is important in the world. All right, so now we have come to the last, I think it is, the last one of these similes. Yes. Okay. Suppose there was a dark forest grove, not far from a town or a village, and there was a tree laden with fruit, yet none of the fruit had fallen to the ground. And along came a person in need of fruit, wandering in search of fruit. Having plunged deep into that forest grove, they'd see that tree laden with fruit. They would think, that tree is laden with fruit, yet none of the fruit has fallen to the ground. But I now have to climb a tree. Why not I climb the tree, eat as much as I like, and then fill my pouch? And that's what they would do. And along would come a second person in need of fruit, wandering in search of fruit, carrying a sharp axe. Having plunged deep into the forest grove, they would see that tree laden with fruit. They would think, that tree is laden with fruit, yet none of the fruit has fallen to the ground. But I do not know how to climb a tree. Why don't I chop this tree down at the root, eat as much as I like, and then fill my pouch? And so they'd chop the tree down at the root. What do you think, householder, if that first person who had climbed the tree doesn't quickly come down, when that tree fell, wouldn't they break their hand or arm or other limb, resulting in death or death-like suffering for them? Yes, sir. So... sensory world for you is pretty rough out there in the sensory world. So this is the idea of the dark forest grove. The dark forest grove is the five sense world, right? And it's actually a very suitable kind of simile. And I'll talk about that in a second, this idea of the dark forest grove. Not far from a town or village. It's not exactly clear what this means here to me, the town or village. Maybe it means like the heavenly realm or something, and you get reborn into the dense forest grove in the human realm. Not sure about that, if it has any significance. Maybe there is no real significance. And then there is a tree laden with fruit in this forest grove. Yeah, no fruit has fallen to the ground. Then the person in need of fruit, that's the person who craves, yeah? Craving for the sensual pleasures in the world, wandering, roaming around, looking for sensual pleasures. Yeah, I was in New York City the other day, wandering around, looking at all the shops, looking at everything in there. This is the jungle of sensual delights. Yeah? When you walk into these shopping districts, Fifth Avenue, New York City, and you kind of wander about. And actually, I didn't see anything very interesting, but so... this is what the world, we're wandering around, that is jungles of sensual pleasures, trying to find the right thing, the good things in the world that are interesting, not just in the city, but anywhere really. and roaming around this realm of ours. And then eventually you find some sensual pleasures that you like. Yeah, you come to the right kind of shop. You know, you come to, I don't know, Armani. I don't know what it is. You know, if you're really wealthy, I suppose. It's kind of, I don't know if anyone shops in these places. I find it kind of, anyway, that's what they do. So maybe, and so you find, you come to this tree. This is kind of the Armani tree, yeah, full of, laden with fruit. And so you climb this tree. Finally, you found your place. Yeah, and you get up into this tree here. Yeah? And you start indulging in the fruit, yeah? Mangoes, yeah? Whatever it is, yeah? Do you like mangoes? Mm-hmm. Like mangoes? Yeah. I don't know. Most people like mangoes, yeah? So you get in this tree, you get some beautiful mangoes, sweet, just ripe, perfect, yeah? And you are kind of indulging in these mangoes. And then while you are indulging in these mangoes, someone comes at the bottom of the tree, yeah? And this is like death, maybe. I don't know what it is that comes to the bottom of the tree. Death comes there, yeah? And cuts the tree down because you are so absorbed in those mangoes, so utterly intoxicated by that taste of those mangoes, you don't even know what's going on. You don't notice this guy at the bottom chopping down the tree here. And this is kind of our life, yeah? While we are in the middle of enjoying sensual pleasures, death comes along and kind of rips out the carpet under our feet, and then we die, and we're kind of confused. Oh, what's going on? Don't know what's happening. Completely intoxicated with the world, and then you're kind of gone. And of course, in the meantime, in the pursuit of those sensual pleasures, you do many bad things. Because this is what intoxication does. This is why being drunk is a bad idea, because if you're drunk, you're intoxicated, you don't know what you're doing. But drunkenness doesn't just happen with alcohol or drugs. Drunkenness can happen in so many areas of life. And one of the areas is just indulging too much in sensual pleasures. That's also a kind of drunkenness. We don't have clarity here. We have a vested interest in that world, and we don't know what's going on. We are lost, in a sense. So this person here is completely, and unless he sobers up in the last moment and regains his mindfulness, like, what's going on? The tree is shaking. It's not just the enjoyment of the mango that makes it shake. It's actually shaking for real. And so he then comes down that tree, comes down to the bottom, and makes an escape before it's too late. And that is us regaining our mindfulness, remembering what is important in life. Yeah, I've got to live well. I've got to do the right thing. I can't just mess around and make all kinds of mistakes and then end up doing heaps of bad karma and then having to take the consequences, like when I die and feel remorse on my deathbed. That's not going to work. So this is kind of the regaining of mindfulness, the realization that indulgence in the sensory world, when it goes too far, is dangerous. And you will notice that if you do indulge in that sensory world too much, you start doing things that you should not be doing. Because that is what that world does to you. This is where all these extramarital affairs comes from, right? If you are really in the power, in the grip of desires, it will seem to be the right thing to do, even though it is not. And then, of course, that ends up with a tragedy for many families, because, you know, you break apart and all these kind of things. But the desire is so strong, at a time it seems right. And then you do bad things. And that is maybe not such an incredibly important thing, but you do even worse things in the name of sensual pleasures, like killing or stealing, etc., lying. All of these things happen as a consequence of intoxication by sensual pleasures. So this is the issue here. So you need to withdraw. Yeah. And how do you withdraw? How do you pull back from these things? And there's a beautiful simile in the suttas where there's a two friends walking through the jungle or walking through the forest grove, just like here. And they come to a hill or a mountain. And then one friend says to the other one, do you know the simile? Adam, I'm going to check you. Maybe, okay. So maybe it's one thing you haven't heard before. Okay, so this is good. So in the simile, the two friends walking along in the forest, they come to the foot of a mountain. And then one friend says to the other one, let's climb the mountain. And they're like, nah, I couldn't be bothered. Yeah, too hard work. Yeah, I'm just going to relax at the bottom. You go to the top and I'll wait for you down here. And so the one friend goes to the top, and then he goes to the top and he looks out, and he sees the view outside, and he shouts down to his friend, you wouldn't believe it. From up here I can see the lakes, the roads, the rivers, the meadows, the fields, the villages, as far as the eye can see. And then His friend at the bottom says, "Nah, I don't believe a word of it. You can't see that up there. There's absolutely no way. What kind of friend is that, right? It's kind of doesn't believe you." So this friend at the top gets a bit exasperated, right? Rightly so, because this is what he's seeing. So he comes down to the bottom, grabs his friend by the arm, and pulls him up to the top, right? "Okay, friend, what do you see?" "Oh, I see meadows, lakes, fields, all of these things." "But didn't you just say now at the bottom of the mountain that you didn't see any of that?" And he said, "Well, actually, yeah, because this whole mountain was blocking my view. That's why I couldn't see these things." And so the mountain is, of course, the five hindrances, right? The mountain is primarily the five, the sensory world, because the main aspect of the five hindrances is the sensory world. This is what blocks us from seeing reality. You can't see the broader landscape. You don't get that bird's eye view. You're stuck in that dark jungle. And this is why the simile uses this idea of the dark forest grove, because it is dark, it is narrow, it is confined. You can't see very far. Yeah. And so you're stuck in this little jungle. And then you have to kind of elevate yourself above the jungle. Go up to the mountaintop, go up to the hilltop, where the trees kind of are no longer there. And it's just bare granite at the top there. So you can see really, really far. And then when you see far, then you can understand the nature of the jungle that you have left behind. Because now you are above it all. Only when you extract yourself from the jungle can you understand the jungle. Just like the tadpole again and the water, you have to get out of things before you can understand what is going on. Yeah, it's a beautiful simile, and it's the idea that we have to elevate, get to the higher mind, the mind that is actually withdrawn from the five-sense world. Only then is it possible to understand what the five-sense world is about. Most people have no idea what they are doing. Most people are just kind of roaming in this jungle all the time, have no idea what it means to elevate yourself out of that jungle. And this is one of the reasons why this idea of free will is so limited. What does it mean to have free will if you are bound to that jungle anyway? What it means you can choose between the banana tree and the mango tree. That's what it means. Big deal, right? You can have a mango or a banana. You can drive this car or that car. It's kind of irrelevant. That is not freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is when you understand the nature of the world and you can actually choose something that really is better, right? That is what freedom of choice is about. So we are limited by our defilements, we're limited by our delusions, we're limited by our lack of perspective on what the world actually is like. Once you have perspective, once you understand the nature of things, then you can make good choices. Then you have a kind of freedom. And the freedom is the freedom from the delusion that blinds you to the nature of reality. So this is what I would call free will in Buddhism. Yeah, it's got nothing to do whether you can have free will to choose bananas or apples. It has to do with freedom from the things, the obstacles that block you from seeing clearly. So this is what happens here. You come above that jungle. One of the interesting things about, I don't know if you have read Ajahn Brahm's book, The Who Ordered the Truckload of Dung? Have you read that book? Yeah? And I really recommend you to read some of these books. They're books of stories, basically, by Ajahn Brahm, but they're often very profound stories. They may just seem like good fun, they may seem like a good story, but actually they're very beautiful. You probably heard them in his talks anyway, but they are there in these books as well. And in one of these stories, is a story of where Ajahn Brahm is in, he's at Cambridge University at the time and has a kind of a break during the summer and he goes off to the Yucatan Peninsula down in Mexico, yeah? Mexico, Guatemala? Yeah, one of those, yeah, Mexico. And maybe it wasn't Guatemala, actually it was. Anyway, he went to some of these ancient, he was in search for these ancient Mayan temples in the jungle down there. And this was back in the 1970s, the early 1970s even, so this is a long time ago. At that time, there was very little tourist traffic. Yeah, they were known about, but things weren't developed the way the tourist trade is these days. And so when he went there, it was really hard to get there. Yeah, he had to travel through the jungle, and it was like this. It was dark and dense. You could only see a few meters away, a few yards away. Yeah, really dense everywhere. And then he said he would eventually, after going down this rickety, on this rickety trucks, on this dodgy roads, and kind of transfer into a canoe and go, not maybe not a canoe, but a boat anyway, on the river. And then on the river, and then eventually he would come to this structure, yeah, which would be one of these ancient temples. And because there was no tourist around, there was no entry fee, there was nothing, you could just walk up these temples. And he said that when he came to the bottom of that temple, then he walked up the stone steps to the top of that temple, it was like a religious experience. Because you had been stuck in the jungle for so long, never seeing very far, always just knowing what was around you. And suddenly now you got elevated out of the jungle. And suddenly from the top of this temple, you could look out, you could see the rivers, you could see the paths in the jungle, you could see the ocean maybe in the distance, right? And all of this became clear. And suddenly you could understand your life, your kingdom, your people in the larger context of what was going around you. It's like a religious experience because you get a perspective on life that you never had before. And so then he says that, well, he can understand why these temples were used maybe for religious initiations and these kind of things, because they had that powerful effect on the mind that transformed your view of the world and your outlook on things in the world. So this is very similar to this sutta thing, right, with going on the hilltop. And I don't know whether Ajahn Brahm read it in the sutta first or whether it just so happens that this is a natural, maybe it's just a natural way of thinking about things. So that is kind of the idea of samadhi, yeah? Samadhi is where the mind gets elevated out of the world. You get the bird's eye view. You look down, and now, for the first time, because you're fully removed from the five senses, for the first time are you able to understand what they really are, what they mean, because you're withdrawn from them. What is it like? Well, what does the Buddha say? It's blissful. It's peaceful. It's beautiful. It is a superior kind of bliss. It's the higher mind. Yeah. This is what these things are. Yeah. So that is the simile of the tree laden with fruit. Yeah. So be very careful not to allow yourself to be too intoxicated by the sensual pleasures of the world. Because when you are intoxicated, you start doing silly things. And when you do silly things, you make bad karma. When you make bad karma, who are you letting down? You're letting yourself down more than anyone else. So just finish off this little sutta. In the same way, a noble disciple reflects. With a simile of the fruit tree, the Buddha said that sensual pleasures give little gratification and much suffering and distress. And they are all the more full of drawbacks. Having truly seen this with right understanding, they reject the equanimity based on diversity and develop only equanimity based on unity, where all kinds of grasping to the world's material delights cease without anything left over. So, those are the seven similes for you. So maybe now is a good time to do a little bit more meditation together, and we can discuss this a bit more afterwards. Okay. Okay, probably enough. Jesus. Okay, so any comments, questions at this point? Yes, please.
Could you say a little more about, or just go back, equanimity from diversity versus equanimity from unity?
Okay, sure. Yeah, so Buddhism, we have kind of many kinds of equanimity, and basically it's kind of the lower equanimities and higher equanimities, and the lower equanimity is just the ability to keep a reasonably even mind in ordinary life. Yeah, you're not kind of pulled around by the defilements of the mind, by the desires and the aversions and the ill will and these kind of things. So you have this nice even mind, and that is already very delightful, to have that kind of mental state where you don't kind of feel that you are under the influence or control of some forces larger than yourself, which basically these defilements are. They're kind of larger forces. And that becomes then the foundation for meditation practice. And then through that meditation practice, you develop the higher kind of equanimities, high kind of upekkha. And so the first one, the equanimity with the five senses, is called equanimity based on diversity, because lots of things are going on, right? It's very kind of a noisy picture, even though your mind is being calmed down, it's still the different senses are still active and things are going on. But then when you come into the jhana states, you get this one-pointedness of mind, where the mind is unified. And that is the idea of the equanimity based on unity, where there is no... The senses have completely disappeared, and the mind is completely unified in one point. And that is a higher kind of equanimity. And that equanimity, the second type, the higher type, that is where you gain the real insights on the Buddhist path. Because that the meaning of the Pali word upekkha literally means to look on. That gives you the ability to look on, because all the biases of the mind have been removed. Yeah, because now you have... all the desires are gone, ill will, all the defilements have temporarily been abandoned. And because you have no biases, and because the mind is in a very powerful state, you now have, the mind is like, it's called imperturbable at this particular point. Anenja is the Pali word. And of course, imperturbable means that the mind can't be moved by anything. The mind is strong, solid, able to deal with any kind of information that comes in, even the most challenging information that may tell you, perhaps, that there is no self. Excuse me. Even that you're able to deal with at this point because of the imperturbability of the mind. So that is the higher kind of upekkha. So, happy with that? Yeah? Okay. Good. Yes, please. Yeah.
Because that's born of craving too.
The chopping down, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So what kind of characters is that in similar?
Maybe that is the people who go to war. I don't know. But I think we hurt each other in the sensory realms. Maybe this is kind of a sign that we are in the pursuit of sensual pleasures, we are hurting each other. We're trying to get hold of the same fruit on the same tree. And as we do that, you know, we hurt each other in the process.
So that one's not shown as less than skillful.
One is less skillful?
Yeah, they're
climbing their... I don't know if one is less skillful. I think they're just different ways of getting hold of the fruit. Yeah, and they're both kind of acceptable. I mean, it's quite a rich simile, and I'm sure you could draw more out of it than what I have come up with. But I think this is kind of the weird thing about in the sensory realm. We hurt each other, even though we don't want to hurt each other. We still do, you know. It's just part and parcel of this realm. Because we compete, we're trying to, we kind of, this is the nature of this.
When you had said about death coming to one climbing the tree.
Yeah. I was just kind of talking, basically. I didn't really kind of consider properly what I was saying at that point. So I you know, it's like sometimes you talk as much as I do here, then sometimes not everything is super well considered, perhaps. They're both searching for mangoes or fruits on the trees. They're both just people in the world, living, searching for sensual pleasures. In the process of doing that, of competing for the same sensual pleasures, they're hurting each other. I think that's probably a better way of looking at it when I think of death coming. I don't think death fits all that well with the imagery that we find here. Please, at the back there. Maybe. I'm not sure. Possibly. Possibly. I'm not entirely sure. Next time I'll see you, I'll give you. Deeper answer, see what happens. Rebecca, please.
A two-pronged question. The first one is, you said that when we move on, that we take with us our good qualities.
Yeah.
Okay. So question number one, do we also take with us our bad qualities? And if we have only good qualities, then we're a non-returner. Is that accurate?
Mm. Yeah, you also take with you your bad qualities, right? Yeah. Yeah.
And if we have only good qualities, then we don't return.
Not quite right. Mm-hmm. But the first point, first of all, the idea about, you know, what is in your mind at the time of death, and I'm kind of assuming here is a good Buddhist, someone who lives well and they feel good about themselves because of that. And it's like, you know, when you sit down in meditation, you relax, you feel reasonably good about yourself. That's kind of the idea here. It's when you let go, you kind of, what remains is a kind of positive feeling here. But that is not true for all people, and there are people, and this is why this is so interesting. When you sit in a meditation, sometimes you may see little things coming up which you rather not see. Yeah, things maybe you regret or whatever it might be in your meditation, and then at least you have some knowledge of what you need to purify, need to sort out, need to deal with. And then you also you maybe your meditation isn't that great. Maybe you're kind of enjoying the peace, and then there's scope for making the mind even more pure, building up those good qualities, that when you come to your deathbed, they're more powerful, and then they kind of transport you in a better way into a, you know, new existence afterwards. Having only good qualities, well, it depends on what you mean by that. So that means just freedom from defilement, sort of. Yeah, that's what you're talking about there. And freedom from defilements can be of two kinds. There can be the freedom that are temporary when you go into a state of samadhi, and there can be the ones that are more permanent, that comes from insight. So it can be that you have a state of samadhi, you get reborn in a jhana realm or a samadhi realm, then of course you come back again. Yeah, but that is really pure mind. That is kind of super duper pure mind. It's like not just kind of any ordinary average good mind. This is the... where there's not anything in sight that is even remotely irritating or bad or whatever. Yeah. And again, you will know whether you are there or not by the ease of access you have to samadhi. How easily do you go into a state of samadhi? If you go easily into a state of samadhi in this life, then that will also happen on your deathbed, yeah, because you have that habit of doing that, and it will go easily. So you can know the quality of your heart by seeing how close you are to samadhi. Yeah. So it's challenging, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Anyone else want to say anything?
Is that samadhi you're talking about jhana or just stillness?
Kind of, it comes in degrees, right? So if you're talking about the full samadhi that is free of defilements, then you're talking about the jhana state. But you can also have lesser kind of samadhi. So it depends on the depth of your samadhi. The deeper your samadhi, the more purified your mind is. Yeah, and if it's a little bit purified, there's a little bit of samadhi, really purified, lots of samadhi, etc. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Yeah. When you say, you know the flowing of your heart by a particular samadhi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm kind of saying. It's like, okay, sometimes I can get to stillness, but you know, I'm far from jhana, so what's the quality of
Well, your quality of your heart is really good, right? Really high quality, yeah? So this is kind of, whoa, really up there. I think that's obvious. But remember that, the thing is that in Buddhism, we're setting the bar incredibly high, right? So when I say, quality, I mean like really super duper pure heart. And this is kind of hard, yeah. This is really, this takes a lot of practice and training to get to those kind of qualities. But if you are reasonably pure, you will, as you say, you will enjoy then a little bit of peace in your meditation practice, yeah. And as you purify it more, that will just deepen and deepen as you go along, yeah. Don't worry too much. I'm always concerned that people will start judging themselves, yeah? And they will think, yeah, I'm not getting into samadhi. Maybe I'm bad, yeah? Bad person. But that would be really the wrong way of thinking about things because we're talking about very elevated states here, and I don't want anyone to kind of blame themselves or think badly about themselves. There's so much of this... So much of this happens in our society. People are lacking in self-worth and these kind of things, yeah? And blaming themselves for the slightest things and thinking they're not good enough or whatever. And that's just often just a lot of rubbish, yeah? They are good people already, but sometimes they're not able to see that properly, the goodness that is already there. And I don't want to kind of get people into thinking in that way because it's so destructive. So just see what you can do more, right? Don't judge yourself one way or the other. See, okay, I'm doing all right, but how can I improve this even further? How can I have more compassion? How can I see more of the good qualities in people around me? How can I reduce any remaining ill will I might have, et cetera, et cetera? Then you're going to be on the right track, yeah. Please, sir. That is how it works, but it also really works from purifying the foundations, yeah, the foundations, yeah. So yeah. Okay, everyone. So I guess that means we can carry on. So this sutta has come to an end. So now we are coming to the very end of these suttas, actually. Now I want to go back to the second sutta we were looking at. This was the shorter simile of the elephant's footprint. We have just looked at that paragraph, yeah, where it says, when they see the sight with their eyes, you have a paragraph there, they don't get caught up in the features and details. It's kind of how far down the sutta, but maybe one page, one and a half page down the sutta from the beginning. When they see a sight with their eyes, they don't get caught up in the feature and details, etc. That is a paragraph. Sorry? Bottom of page 3, it says, okay, yep. I don't have page numbers here, so I don't know, but yep, thanks. So that is the, as I mentioned before, this is this famous sense restraint formula that you find throughout the suttas. And the detour we have made over the last couple of days have really been just an expansion on that paragraph. Yeah, we had a look at the two kinds of thought, how you divide the thoughts into the world. Then we had a look at the five ways of overcoming bad thoughts, the Vitakka Santana Sutta. Then we had a look at the Agata Pativinaya Sutta, how to overcome resentment and ill will. And now lastly, we had a look at the Potalya Sutta, which is about how to reflect on the sensory world in a good way. So all of this is about, you can see how all of this is around, revolves around the idea of wisdom, around the idea of seeing things in the right way, so you can take good actions as a consequence. So it's all, so sense restraint, all of it really is about being as wise as possible and applying your mind in a wise way. And so this whole formula is really about these kind of things. And so you can get an idea what is going on here now. Yeah, you are refining your mind, you are abandoning the ill will, which gives more rise to compassion and understanding in the world of other people, which is a very useful thing. It is one of the biggest hindrances for meditation practice. And once you have refined your mind of that ill will, the second big problem, which actually is an even bigger problem, is the problem of the five sense world. And the purpose of contemplating the five sense world and seeing its downside is to enable your mind to reach a higher level. That's kind of the purpose of this. So be careful when you use these kind of contemplations. Use them in a wise way. Don't contemplate this thing in a way that makes you kind of sad or depressed. Remember that it is important on the Buddhist path that we don't just look at the negative sides of existence, but we build up the positive feelings that come from Dhamma practice at the same time. Being able, once you build up the good feelings, it actually enables you to see more clearly what is going on in the world. You have more ability to understand the idea of suffering and impermanence and these kind of things. So you build up both together. And then having the happiness fortifies the mind, enables it to deal with the reality of the world. When you deal with the reality of the world, it makes you more able to find the joy within, because the world becomes less important. That allows more insight, and then kind of stage by stage, these things build up and up and up until you reach the very end of the path. So be balanced in how you approach these things. Then you're going to have success in this practice. So that is the the paragraph on sense restraint. So now we're going to do the rest of the gradual training, and this is what we're going to do now, and then continuing on tomorrow morning. That's kind of the plan, if you like. So we'll see what happens. So the next thing here is about situational awareness. And situational awareness is called Sati Sampajanya in Pali. And Sati Sampajanya is often translated as clear comprehension or full awareness. Clear comprehension is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Situational awareness is Bhante Sujato's translation. Just different flavors, different angles on the same idea. And the reason why Bhante Sujato calls it situational awareness is because this is being aware of how to act in different kinds of situations in life. A lot of the Dhamma revolves around the idea of meditation practice. But what when we don't meditate, what about then? So that is where we have situational awareness, the various situations in life, and then we act in the appropriate way in those situations. So this is what this is about. So they act with situational awareness. First of all, take away the when and put in either in or about, in going out or coming back, or about going out or coming back. So they act with situational awareness in going out and coming back, in looking ahead and aside, in bending and extending their limbs, when bearing the outer robe, the bowl and the robes, when eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, waking, speaking and keeping silent. So here, again, we are dealing with the monastic path. It has to do with robes and bowls and these kind of things. And again, these are all the activities that you do outside of meditation practice. So this is all those things. So you deal with those things in an appropriate manner. This is what this is about. So let's just have a quick look at what is going on here. So we have going out and coming back. This is usually means like you're going an alms round, yeah? So a monastic goes into the village, or here you go over to the, what's that building called over there? You go over to that building over there? Yeah, that's where the alms round, very short alms round. But so you go there and you come back. So you have clear awareness about that. So what does that mean, clear awareness about that? So what it means, or situational awareness, or whatever, what does it mean? What it means is that you do these things in such a way that they advance the practice of the path. Yeah, they are suitable for the practice of the path. That is really what it means. So if you go, for example, into the village, you're a monk or a nun, you go into the village, you don't go into the village to look at all the beautiful sights, yeah, look at all the whatever it is that kind of is interesting and exciting in town, yeah, the latest entertainment or the beautiful young people or whatever it is. You don't look at that. Yeah, you go into the city or the village to receive alms food, and you are clear about that purpose. And so you do that in the right way. Yeah, so this is kind of the idea here. The commentary defines the idea of situational awareness or full awareness as being fourfold. And two of those things are the most important one. It talks about the purpose and suitability of what you're doing here. So if you're going into the village to receive alms, well, that is the purpose. The purpose is to receive alms, nothing else. Suitability means that is this particular village the suitable place to go? So purpose and suitability, they're very closely related to each other, right? Purpose and suitability, they almost become like one thing here. But and it means, are you doing what is appropriate to progress the spiritual path? That's really what it means. You don't do things that are detrimental to your spiritual practice. So this is the monastic life, yeah? So walking in, coming back again, looking aside, looking ahead. This is like if you're looking to see if someone wants to give you alms, yes? You kind of look. Yeah, you just look aside for that purpose, nothing else. Bending and extending your limbs, right? This is like you put out your ball, you retrieve it again. Bearing your outer robe, ball and robes. Yeah, so you bear these things in the appropriate way. What is suitable according to the etiquette and all of that kind of things, and you do it just for that reason. Eating, drinking, chewing and tasting. You have full awareness about that. What does that mean? You can see here, you start to see why the translation in is better than when. Because very often in Buddhism, one of the things that you will hear is that when you eat, have mindfulness while you eat, right? It's a very kind of common thing you will hear in Buddhist circles. You go on a retreat and say, okay, be mindful while you eat. But actually, that particular way of thinking about it comes from this kind of paragraph, yeah, but this is where it is kind of specifically mentioned in the suttas. I think the meaning isn't that at all. The meaning is not when you are eating, you're supposed to be mindful. It means that you're supposed to have full awareness in regard to these things. That is quite different. Because in regard to those things means that you eat the suitable amount. Not too little, so you're going to be hungry later on. Not too much, so you kind of feel bloated and overfull. Yeah, you eat food that is suitable, whatever that might be for you. People have different suitability as far as food is concerned. Yeah, so it's that kind of mindfulness about what you're doing. Yeah? Because just being mindful of while you're eating without any larger kind of purpose, without any framework for why you're mindful, it doesn't make that much sense, because everything you have to be mindful for a particular reason. Yeah, not just for mindfulness on its own right. The idea of being mindfulness just for its own purpose, just for being mindful, the idea behind that is very often, well, if you are mindful, then when you sit down and meditate, the mindfulness will be easy to access, because mindfulness begets mindfulness. That's kind of the idea behind that. But actually, the Buddha doesn't say that mindfulness begets mindfulness. He says that the first factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, that is what makes you mindful. So what is important is that you do the right thing in daily life. Practice in the right way, make sure you don't allow any defilements to arise. Practice kindness and all these kind of things, and then mindfulness will emerge from that. But not just from being mindful and forcing yourself to be mindful in daily life. So why am I saying all of this? Well, I'm saying all of this. If you look a bit further down, It says, first of all, it says when urinating and defecating, you have to be mindful then, all right, okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure why that is mentioned specifically, but there you are. Then when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, and then it has sleeping, right? When sleeping, you're supposed to have situational awareness. And there you can see the drawback of this particular translation and why it doesn't work. And many people make this, what I consider a mistake of translation. This is a mistake done by Bhante Sujato. Bhikkhu Bodhi has made the same mistake, if I dare say so. interesting, I pointed it out to Bhante Sujato, and he changed it straight away when I pointed it out, because it doesn't make any sense to be fully aware when you are sleeping, right? But if you change the translation and it says you are fully aware in respect of sleeping, yeah, or about sleeping, or in regard to sleeping, or in sleeping, whatever it is, then the meaning is that you know the right amount to sleep, yeah, the right kind of bed that is suitable, and all of those kind of things. Then it starts to make sense, right? Because then it is about getting enough rest, not too much rest, because then you get groggy, not too little rest, then you're also groggy, yeah, etc., etc. Then things kind of start to make sense again. So this is why that is the, as far as I can tell, the appropriate translation in this. Now, how do you know? And the only reason I can say that is because I know a little bit about Pali grammar. So I know the kind of grammar which is possible. I know the kind of translations that actually are possible here. If you don't know anything about Pali grammar, you wouldn't be able to make that kind of a judgment. So this is why sometimes knowing a little bit of Pali can be helpful. Anyway, but if you catch that by knowing a little bit of Pali, that would be pretty impressive. But anyway. Full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, speaking, right? You know the right amount to speak, the right kind of speech. You stop when you know you talk too much. You don't, also the right amount to keep, also when you're keeping silent, yeah, you know when to be silent. In Buddhism, it is not always about being silent. Right speech does not mean silent all the time. It means speaking in the right way at the appropriate times, yeah? That's an important point. So all of these things you are aware of, and you have a sense about what actually works for you on the path or not. And if you force yourself to be silent too much, it is going to be counterproductive, because it's going to feel oppressive if you try too hard. On the other hand, you don't want to talk too much, because that just makes your mind restless and start thinking about all kinds of things. So for that reason, again, you have to be balanced in your approach. And this seems to be very difficult for human beings to be balanced. We tend to be extreme, yeah? Yeah, people are they completely gung-ho and they go into monastic life. I'm going to keep all the ascetic practices, yeah? Some monks are like this, they're super tough, and they last exactly 3 months, and then they're back to lay life again. It's true, because it's just untenable. It is possible if your meditation is going really well, then it can be done. But if you do that without having meditation, there's no way it's going to be sustainable. So this is the idea of having clear comprehension or full awareness. And this can also be then extended into lay life. This is the monastic way of things. But you can ask yourself if the things you are doing are suitable for keeping the defilements in check, yeah? Is this purposeful for the path? Is it going to lead to anger? If you watch the news too much, you might get upset, right? Reading too much news on the internet, too much bad things happening in the world, and you kind of get upset, and it kind of destroys your gladness and happiness. So often I think we can easily consume less news, probably. I don't know, is anyone here who's a news junkie? Yeah, not news junkie at the back there. Okay, news junkie. Okay, it's very common to be a news junkie, right? People love to read the news in various ways, but sometimes a news diet is probably better than being a news junkie. Because it's not all that helpful. If you do watch the news, make sure you remember to watch it from a Buddhist kind of a point of view, so you kind of draw all the right conclusions from what you're seeing on the news. So this is one way of thinking about the idea of full awareness in lay life, right? Remember the things that kind of draw you away from the path, the things that make you upset, yeah? Sometimes the people we are around, make sure you choose good friends, yeah? Kalyanamitas, good spiritual friends. And if you find that some people upset you too much, maybe don't kind of reject them completely, but maybe less kind of, you know, social engagement with those people who are very difficult and problematic. And that's perfectly okay to make those kind of choices in life. And then you kind of start to guide your life on the right way. Don't go to the casino too often, right? Those kind of things. Casinos are bad. So then, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, yeah, in terms of kind of things that are unhelpful in life, and you can start to see these things going in the right way. So there is higher degrees as well of this full awareness, Satisampajanya. This is the beginning point. But Satisampajanya is also part of the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is a very interesting kind of textual, this is kind of hard, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to explain this, but in the Satipatthana Sutta, you have like a preamble, first of all, where it says that you dwell in this way, and you are it gives a number of qualities, how you dwell. You dwell observing a body in the body, and you are Satima Atapi Sampajano. Yeah, Satima means mindful, Satima. Atapi means you have energy in your practice. And Sampajano is this thing we're talking about here. Sampajanya, full awareness. So these are the qualities you bring into your meditation practice according to the Satipatthana Sutta. And then it says Vinaya Loka Abhijadomanasa, which means having abandoned desire and aversion for the world. So this is there at the beginning. So what that means is that also in Satipatthana practice, you bring this quality of sampajanya, full awareness, into that practice. But now it is in meditation practice. I said before, it is outside of meditation, and you kind of, hopefully you have some idea what I was talking about there, but now we're talking about within meditation. So what does it mean? Well, it means largely the same thing, yeah? As you are watching the breath, you are aware of whether your mind is kind of going astray, fantasizing about things, going into the future, going into the past. You are aware of whether you are fulfilling the purpose of that practice. Yeah, it's about purpose. Or are you losing the plot and kind of being everywhere else? So again, the idea of suitability and purpose actually is also relevant for ordinary meditation practice. But there is an additional aspect in the suttas, or in the commentaries, they talk about four aspects of sampajanya. I don't know if you are aware of that. Some of you may be aware of that. I always look towards you, Adam, when I think about this. There's always, in a group like this, there are some people who know a lot about the suttas, some who know zero, and most people somewhere in between. But that's fine. It's good to have that kind of diversity, so it's no problem at all. So four aspects of full awareness according to the commentary. So I already mentioned purpose, suitability. Then there's something called gochara, which means, literally means where the cows go, or the cows hang out. That's literally what it means. Go is cow. Is it, by the way, related to the word cow? Go, cow. Yeah, they're actually related to each other. Chara means to behave, or to where you go, basically, where you stay. So gochara is a field. That's where the cows hang out. They hang out in the fields, right? So gochara is the field. So it is the field for a monastic when you do meditation, or for anyone when you do meditation. The field is what you are aware of. It's the object, basically, right? So you have the right object. And according to the commentaries, the idea is that you have the object in mind at all times, which kind of makes sense. If you're watching the breath, ideally, you are with the object all the time, especially when the meditation goes well. But that gochara, having the meditation object in mind at all times, does not relate to what we saw before, yeah, when you go into the village. Yeah, go into the village, come back, you do all your daily activities. You should not be aware of your meditation object at all times. This is a story from, should I say who? Maybe I can say who. Look, Venerable Analayo, right down here. Yeah. This is a story from him, yeah? And he said that he had tried this commentarial technique, and I would argue that he had misunderstood the commentary, that this idea of gochara, of the field that you go to, only applies to meditation. It does not apply to those other activities. But he said he tried that on arms around, right? So he used to live in Sri Lanka. He was in Sri Lanka for 20 years or something. And in Sri Lanka, they follow the traditional ways. You go to arms around into the village, yeah? I have been there, done that. It's very beautiful and very charming. Yeah? I love going to Buddhist countries sometimes because you are immersed in the Buddhist culture. Yeah? And that is sometimes very delightful if you are a monk. You feel at home there, right? In the West, you feel like the odd, you feel like this weirdo in the West. And people look at you as if you are a weirdo as well, yeah? And fair enough, I can understand why they do that. But you come to Sri Lanka, okay, everyone embraces you, yeah? You're part of the kind of part of the culture. And it's actually, sometimes that's very beautiful. Yeah? And so anyway, so he was in Sri Lanka, and then he said he was going to try this practice, right? Going on arms around and focusing on your meditation object while you are on arms around. So he was watching his breath on his arms around. He started walking, right? Walking, walking, watching the breath. And suddenly he realized he had no idea where he was. Because he wasn't even able to follow the route, right? Because the breath is such a subtle thing. That's all you can see. Everything else blurs out and disappears. And so, no, this is not going to work. This is the wrong way. And I think he refined his technique of meditation a little bit after that, trying that out. So this shows you that this works when you sit down. That is when you do meditation. Don't try this technique of being with your meditation object at all times. I think that's a misunderstanding of how this is to be done. It just doesn't work. It can't be done, basically. And there is nowhere in the suttas that actually says you should do that. So this is a false interpretation of this particular passage. And then there's a fourth characteristic of sampajanya, and then there's the characteristic of can't remember now, but it's basically the idea that you don't take anything as a self, right? So you have clear awareness that there is no self in this. It's just conditioned phenomena moving and changing all the time. But that is even more profound, and that is really only possible after you become a stream enterer. Once you are a stream enterer, once you are a sotapanna, and you have seen the nature of all of these things, then you can do that. Before that, it's actually quite impossible. So these are the four levels. Every one of us really should focus on in ordinary life is just the idea, is what I'm doing, is it purposeful? Is it suitable? Yeah, is it appropriate? Am I just letting myself down by, you know, doing silly things or whatever in life? Things that you know are detrimental to yourself. Of course, sometimes we do detrimental things. Sometimes it's unavoidable. Sometimes we need a bit of a break or whatever, or we can't take this life too seriously. Sometimes this, if you follow this rigidly, you get a life that is far too strict and serious, and all joy goes out the window and there's no happiness anymore. So don't take these things too strictly. Take them as a kind of general guidelines for how to live your life, and then you're going to be on the right track. That is the idea of sati sampajanya. Let me read a little bit more, because otherwise I'm afraid we're going to have too much for tomorrow morning. So let me just read a little bit more, just one tiny little paragraph here. So when they have this noble spectrum of ethics, this noble contentment, this noble sense restraint, this noble mindfulness and situational awareness, they frequent a secluded lodging, a wilderness, the foot of a tree, a hill, a ravine, a mountain cave, a charnel ground, a forest, an open air, or a heap of straw. Yeah, so once you have built up all of these things, all the ethical side of things, the contentment, the restraint of the senses, so you kind of your mind is stable within, and also the situational awareness, only at this point do you think about meditation practice. So that's kind of fascinating. That shows you how elevated the idea of meditation is in the suttas. This is not the kind of mindfulness-based stress reduction things, which is good, but this is an altogether different level of mindfulness. All of those things have to be in place, then you go into the secluded lodging, right? Then you're ready for complete seclusion because your mind is so pure that you're able to deal with seclusion fully. So now we're coming to the meditation, finally, after all of these preparations. Meditation is coming here. So this is a standard kind of beginning for all passages where they talk about meditation practice. You know now we are dealing with meditation. And so what is this secluded lodging? It sounds a bit weird to call these things lodgings. The wilderness, is that a lodging? I don't know. I'd better to translate it as a secluded resting place or something like that. Because lodging to me is more like a building. So these are the various kinds of lodgings you can choose between according to the suttas. It's a standard list that you find. The wilderness, the foot of a tree where you very often find the Buddha. A hill, this is just, this is kind of the traditional sage that you see in the comics, sitting on top of the hill, right? That's kind of the, they kind of climb up the mountain and you ask the sage. A ravine, so a ravine is like a kind of steep thing, you sit, you kind of go into, maybe it's very peaceful and quiet there. A mountain cave, this is kind of a classical place for Buddhist monastics to hang out, in caves, wherever that might be. Charnel ground is a great place for monastics. Usually if you go to a charnel ground, you get left in peace, especially in Asia, because you go to places like Thailand and people are afraid of charnel grounds, because that's where the ghosts are. And if you grow up in a country like Thailand, I don't know what it's like in Sri Lanka, but in Thailand, if you grow up, you are taught so many ghost stories as a child, you are absolutely, completely afraid of anywhere there might be ghosts. Is it like that in Sri Lanka as well? Or... No? Okay, not so much in Sri Lanka, but I know in Thailand, this is part of Thai culture. And Ajahn Brahm always tells me that, when you go to a charnel ground, you're left completely in peace. No one is going to kind of ever disturb you. And Ajahn Brahm told me the time when he was, this was while he was still in Thailand, long, long time ago now, back in the 1970s probably. And he said to his fellow monks, I'm going to go off to the charnel ground to meditate. They said, no, don't go to the charnel ground, And they're holding him back because they were so afraid of the ghost. They were afraid on his behalf, right? You're going to be harassed by ghosts. No, hold back. And in Thailand, the culture is very different in terms of physical contact, So they literally grab hold of him and hold him back, right? And it's very kind of sweet and very... But that's kind of how that works. So charnel grounds are often good places. So if you are ever in Asia, there's too much noise because then... Go to the charnel ground and you're going to be in business. So or a forest, or the open air, or a heap of straw. I love the last one, the heap of straw, right? It's like a bean bag, and you're just kind of chilling out, relaxing. Go to the forest, find the heap of straw. And this shows us again, this thing about the idea of the Buddhist way being the middle way. You're not being harsh on the body. You find a heap of straw, you really relax on that heap of straw, and the body is not painful, you're not indulging the body, hopefully. You find that middle way, And it's another sign of the middle way. So this is where meditation begins. It is something that happens in seclusion. And the reason why it happens in seclusion is because the process of meditation, the purpose of this, is to lead to samadhi. And if you want to achieve samadhi, it starts with the kaya viveka, the seclusion of the body, which then always is the precursor for the citta viveka, the seclusion of the mind. You need to withdraw the senses from the world, from the noise, the disturbance, the impact of the five senses. And only when you withdraw externally, is it possible for the mind to also withdraw from those things? So now the scene is set for meditation, right? So tomorrow we are ready to talk more about meditation practice. So it is almost exactly 4:00. So that is all for now. So have a nice afternoon and a nice dinner or whatever, and then we'll see you back again at 7:00 this evening, and I will be doing some interviews over there as usual. Okay.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.